The Master and Margarita, Disc 5.
Chapter 11. Ivan is split in two. The wood on the opposite shore of the river, which just an hour ago had been shining in the May sun, now grew blurry and dim, and then dissolved. A veil of water hung outside the window. Threads of lightning kept flashing in the sky, the heavens split open, and a fearsome, flickering light flooded the sick man's room. Ivan cried softly as he sat on his bed and looked out at the turbid, frothing, bubbling river. With every clap of thunder he let out a piteous cry and covered his face in his hands. Sheets of paper covered with Ivan's writing lay on the floor. They had been blown about by the wind, which had swept through the room before the storm began. The poet's attempts to compose a report on the terrible consultant had come to nothing. As soon as he received a pencil stub and some paper from the stout nurse, whose name was Praskovya Fyodorovna, he had rubbed his hands together in a businesslike fashion and hastily set to work at the bedside table. He had dashed off a smart beginning. To the police. From Ivan Nikolaevich Bezdomny. Member of Masolit. Report. Yesterday evening I arrived at Patriarch's Ponds with the deceased Berlioz. And the poet immediately became confused, largely due to the word deceased. It made everything sound absurd from the start. How could he have arrived somewhere with the deceased? Dead men don't walk. They really will think I'm a madman. Such thoughts made him start revising. The second version came out as follows. With Berlioz, later deceased. That didn't satisfy the author either. He had to write a third version, and that came out even worse than the other two. With Berlioz, who fell under a streetcar. What was irksome here was the obscure composer who was Berlioz's namesake. He felt compelled to add, not the composer. Tormented by these two Berliozes, Ivan crossed everything out and decided to begin with a strong opening that would immediately get the reader's attention. He began with a description of the cat boarding the streetcar, and then went back to the episode of the severed head. The head and the consultant's prediction made him think of Pontius Pilate, and in order to make the report more convincing, he decided to include the whole story about the procurator, starting with the moment when he came out onto the colonnade of Herod's palace, dressed in a white robe with a blood-red lining. Ivan worked hard, crossing out what he had written and adding new words. He even tried to do drawings of Pontius Pilate and of the cat on its hind legs. But the drawings didn't help either, and the more the poet worked, the more confused and incomprehensible his report became. By the time an ominous storm cloud with smoking edges had appeared from the distance and enveloped the woods, and the wind had blown the papers off the table, Ivan felt drained of energy and unable to cope with the report. Making no effort at all to pick up the scattered pages, he burst into silent and bitter tears. The kind-hearted nurse, Praskovya Fyodorovna, came by to check on Ivan during the storm and was upset to see him crying. She closed the blinds so that the lightning would not frighten him, picked up the papers from the floor, and ran off with them to get the doctor. The doctor appeared, gave Ivan an injection in his arm, and assured him that he would stop crying, that now everything would pass, everything would change, and all would be forgotten. The doctor turned out to be right. The wood across the river started to look as it had before. It stood out sharply, down to the last tree, beneath the sky which had been restored to its former perfect blueness, and the river grew calm. Ivan's anguish began to diminish right after the injection. And now the poet lay peacefully, gazing at the rainbow spread across the sky. Things stayed this way until evening, and he never even noticed when the rainbow evaporated, the sky faded and grew sad, and the wood turned black. Ivan drank some hot milk, lay down again, and was himself surprised at how his thoughts had changed. The image of the demonic, accursed cat had somehow softened in his memory. The severed head no longer frightened him, and when Ivan stopped thinking about the head, he began to reflect on how the clinic wasn't so bad, everything considered. and how Stravinsky was a clever fellow and a celebrity, and extremely pleasant to have dealings with. And besides, the evening air was sweet and fresh after the storm. The asylum was falling asleep. The frosted white lights in the quiet corridors went out, and in accordance with regulations, the faint blue nightlights came on, and the cautious steps of the nurses were heard less frequently on the rubber matting in the corridor outside the door. Now Ivan lay in a state of sweet lethargy, gazing now at the shaded lamp, which cast a mellow light down from the ceiling, now at the moon, which was emerging from the black wood. He was talking to himself. "Why did I get so upset over Berlioz falling under a streetcar?" the poet reasoned. "In the final analysis, let him rot. What am I to him anyway, kith or kin? If we examine the question properly, it turns out that I, essentially, didn't really know the deceased. What did I actually know about him? Nothing. Except that he was bald and horribly eloquent. And so, citizens," continued Ivan, addressing an invisible audience, "let us examine the following. Explain, if you will, why I got so furious at that mysterious consultant, magician, and professor with the black vacant eye. What was the point of that whole absurd chase with me in my underwear carrying a candle? And what about that grotesque scene in the restaurant?" But, said the old Ivan to the new Ivan, addressing him in a stern voice from somewhere inside his head or behind his ear. "But didn't he know in advance that Berlioz's head would be cut off? How could you not get upset?" "What is there to discuss, comrades?" retorted the new Ivan to the broken-down old Ivan. "Even a child can see that there is something sinister about all this. He is, no doubt about it, a mysterious and exceptional personality. But that's what makes it so interesting. The fellow was personally acquainted with Pontius Pilate. What could be more interesting than that? And instead of making that ridiculous scene at Patriarch's Ponds, wouldn't it have been better to have asked him politely about what happened next to Pilate and the prisoner Hanotsri? But instead I got obsessed with the devil knows what. Is it such an earth-shattering event that an editor got run over? Does it mean the magazine will have to close down? So what can you do? Man is mortal, and, as was said so fittingly, sometimes suddenly so. Well, God rest his soul. There'll be a new editor, and maybe he'll be even more eloquent than the last one." After dozing off for a while, the new Ivan asked the old Ivan, spitefully, "So how do I look in all this?"
"Like a fool," a bass voice pronounced distinctly, a voice which did not come from either one of the Ivans, and was amazingly reminiscent of the consultant's bass. For some reason, Ivan did not take offense at the word fool, but was pleasantly surprised by it, smiled, and fell into a half-sleep. Sleep was creeping up on Ivan, and he could already see a palm tree on an elephant-like trunk, and a cat went by, not a fearsome one, but a jolly one. And in short, sleep was about to engulf him, when suddenly the window grill moved aside noiselessly, and a mysterious figure who was trying to hide from the moonlight appeared on the balcony and shook a warning finger at Ivan. Not feeling the least bit afraid, Ivan raised himself in bed and saw that there was a man on the balcony. And this man pressed his finger to his lips and whispered, "Shh." Chapter 12. Black Magic and Its Exposé. A little man with a pear-shaped, raspberry-colored nose, wearing checked trousers, patent leather shoes, and a yellow bowler hat full of holes, rode out onto the stage of the Variety Theater on an ordinary two-wheeled bicycle. He made a circle to the accompaniment of a foxtrot, and then let out a triumphant hoot as he made his bicycle stand up on end. While riding on just the back wheel,
The man turned upside down and managed at the same time to unscrew the front wheel and send it off stage. He then continued his ride on the one wheel, pedaling with his hands. Next appeared a buxom blonde in tights and a short skirt speckled with silver stars, who circled around on a unicycle perched on top of a long metal pole. As they passed each other, the man shouted out greetings and tipped his hat to her with his foot. The last to come out was a child of about 8, with an old man's face, who darted in between the two adults on a tiny two-wheeler outfitted with a huge automobile horn. After making several loops, the entire company pedaled up to the very edge of the stage to the accompaniment of an anxious drum roll from the orchestra. The spectators seated in the front rows gasped and pulled back in their seats, for it seemed as if all three performers were about to come crashing down into the orchestra with their cycles. But the bicycles stopped short, just as their front wheels threatened to skid off into the orchestra pit and onto the musicians' heads. With a loud cry of whoop, the cyclists jumped off their bikes and bowed, and the blonde threw kisses to the audience, while the child made a funny noise on his horn. The theater shook with applause, and the pale blue curtain drew together from both sides, hiding the cyclists from view. The green lights of the exit signs went out, and in the web of the trapezes under the dome, the white globes of the house lights began to blaze like the sun. It was the intermission, before the final part of the program. The only person to have no interest whatsoever in the wonders of the Giuli family's cycling technique was Grigory Danilovich Rimsky. He was sitting all alone in his office, biting his thin lips, and his face kept twitching convulsively. Likhodyeyev's strange disappearance was now compounded by the utterly unforeseen disappearance of the manager Varenuha. Rimsky knew where he had gone, but he had gone there and not come back. Rimsky hunched his shoulders and whispered to himself, "But why?" And what is odd is that it would have been simpler than anything for a man as businesslike as the financial director to call the place where Varenuha had gone and find out what had happened to him. However, 10 o'clock was approaching, and he still couldn't bring himself to do it. At 10, Rimsky took himself firmly in hand and picked up the receiver, only then to discover that his phone was dead. The messenger boy reported that the other phones in the building were also out of order. This admittedly unpleasant but hardly supernatural occurrence completely unnerved the financial director and yet delighted him as well. He wouldn't have to make the call. Just as the red light signaling the start of intermission began to flicker above the financial director's head, the messenger boy came in and announced that the foreign artiste had arrived. For some reason, this made the financial director wince with pain. Turning darker than a storm cloud, he headed backstage to receive the guest artiste, there being no one left but him to do so. Those who were curious were using various pretexts to peer into the large dressing room off the corridor where the bells signaling the end of intermission were already ringing. Among them were conjurers in bright robes and turbans, a roller skater in a white knitted jacket, a storyteller whose face was pale with powder, and a makeup man. The visiting celebrity astounded everyone with his unusually long and splendidly cut tailcoat, and by the fact that he was wearing a black eye mask. But even more amazing were the black magician's two companions, a tall fellow in checks, with a broken pince-nez and a fat black cat who walked into the dressing room on his hind paws and then proceeded to make himself comfortable on the couch, squinting at the naked bulbs on the makeup mirror. Trying to put a smile on his face, which only made it look sour and mean, Rimsky bowed to the silent magician who was sitting on the couch next to the cat. No one shook hands, but the overly familiar fellow in checks introduced himself as their assistant. This surprised the financial director, and unpleasantly so, since there had been absolutely nothing in the contract about any assistant. Dryly and very tensely, Grigory Danilovich asked the fellow in checks, who had fallen on him out of the blue, where the artiste's equipment was.
Why, our most precious director, our diamond from heaven, how quaint you are!
Answered the magician's assistant in a quavering voice.
Our equipment is always with us. Here it is, eins, zwei, drei.
He then wiggled his gnarled fingers in front of Rimsky's eyes and suddenly pulled out Rimsky's gold watch and chain from behind the cat's ear. Up until now it had been in the financial director's vest pocket, underneath his buttoned jacket, with its chain looped through the buttonhole. Rimsky grabbed his stomach involuntarily. The onlookers gasped, and the makeup man, who was peering in through the door, clucked approvingly.
"Could this be your watch? Please take it," said the fellow in checks, smiling in an overly familiar way as he handed the flustered Rimsky his property on a grubby palm.
"You wouldn't want to get on a streetcar with the likes of him," whispered the storyteller gaily to the makeup man. But then the cat pulled a trick that was even more skillful than the one with Rimsky's watch. Suddenly rising from the couch, he walked on his hind paws to the table under the mirror, pulled the stopper out of the carafe, poured some vodka into a glass, drank it, put the stopper back in place, and then wiped his whiskers off with a makeup rag. This time, no one even gasped. Mouths simply opened wide. And the makeup man whispered ecstatically, "Now that's first class!" At this point, the third bell rang, and everyone, keyed up and anticipating an exciting act, rushed out of the dressing room. A minute later, the lights dimmed in the auditorium, and the footlights came on, casting a reddish glow on the bottom of the curtain. A stout fellow, clean-shaven and cheerful as a baby, wearing rumpled tails and soiled linen, appeared through the brightly lit opening in the curtain and stood before the audience. This was the master of ceremonies, Georgi Biengalski, well known to all of Moscow.
"And so, citizens," began Biengalski, smiling a baby-like grin, "now I would like to present..."
Here he interrupted himself and began speaking in a different tone.
"I see that our audience has increased for the third part of the program. Half the city is here with us today. Just recently, I met a friend and said to him, 'Why don't you come and see us? Yesterday, half the city was here.' And he says, 'But I live in the other half.'"
Biengalski paused, expecting a burst of laughter. But when none came, he continued.
"And so I would like to present the famous foreign artiste, Monsieur Voland, in a performance of black magic. Of course, you and I know..." Here Biengalski smiled a knowing smile, "that there is no such thing in the world as black magic, and it is nothing other than superstition, and that Maestro Voland is simply a master of conjuring technique, a fact which will become obvious in the most interesting part of his performance, that is, when he reveals the secrets behind his technical skill. And so, since we all applaud both expertise and its exposé, let us welcome Mr. Voland."
After delivering this whole spiel, Biengalski pressed his palms together and waved them in welcoming fashion at the opening in the curtain, whereupon it drew apart with a soft rustle. The entrance of the magician with his tall assistant and his cat, who came out on stage on his hind paws, made a big hit with the audience. "An armchair, if you will," Voland commanded softly, and that very second an armchair appeared on stage out of nowhere, and the magician sat down.
"Tell me, dear Fagot," inquired Voland of the buffoon in checks, who obviously had another name besides Korovyov, "have the Muscovites changed, in your opinion, in any significant way?"
The magician looked out over the hushed audience, which was still stunned by the chair's sudden appearance out of thin air.
"Indeed they have, monsieur," was Fagot Korovyov's soft reply.
"You are right. They have changed a great deal. On the outside, I mean, as has the city, by the way. Apart from the obvious changes in dress, there are now these, what are they called? Streetcars, automobiles."
"Buses,"
Fagot chimed in respectfully. The audience listened attentively to this conversation, thinking it was the prelude to the magic tricks. In the crowd of performers and stagehands backstage, Rimsky's pale, tense face could be seen. Bengalski, who had moved to the side of the stage, began to look bewildered. He raised his eyebrows slightly and, taking advantage of the pause, said, "The foreign artiste is expressing his delight with Moscow, which has advanced technologically and with its inhabitants as well." Here, Bengalski smiled twice, first at the orchestra and then at the gallery. Voland, Fagot, and the cat turned their heads toward the master of ceremonies. "Did I really express delight?" the magician asked Fagot.
"No, indeed, monsieur, you expressed no delight whatsoever,"
was Fagot's reply. "So what is this man talking about?"
"He simply lied,"
pronounced the assistant in Czechs, booming out his words to the entire theater. And turning to Bengalski, he added,
"My compliments, citizen, on your lies."
Laughter broke out in the gallery, and Bengalski shuddered, his eyes bulging. "But I, of course, am not so much interested in buses, telephones, and such..."
"Apparatus," prompted the fellow in Czechs.
"Exactly so. Thank you," said the magician, slowly, in a deep bass. "A much more important question is, have the Muscovites changed on the inside?"
"Indeed, sir, that is a most important question."
Backstage, people began exchanging looks and shrugging their shoulders. Bengalski stood red-faced and Rimsky was pale. But at this point, the magician seemed to sense the growing alarm and said, "However, we've gotten carried away, dear Fagot, and the audience is beginning to get bored. Show us something simple, for starters." The audience stirred with relief. Fagot and the cat walked along the footlights to opposite ends of the stage. Fagot snapped his fingers and shouted cavalierly, "Three, four!" He then pulled a deck of cards out of thin air, shuffled it, and tossed it like a ribbon to the cat. The latter caught the ribbon of cards and threw it back. The satin snake gave a snort, Fagot opened his mouth wide like a fledgling, and swallowed all of it, card after card. After that, the cat made a bow, shuffled his right hind paw, and received thunderous applause. "First class! First class!" people cried rapturously from backstage. Fagot pointed his finger at the orchestra section and announced,
"The deck of cards is now, my esteemed citizens, in row 7 in Citizen Parchevsky's possession, that is, lodged just in between a 3-ruble note and a summons to appear in court for non-payment of alimony to Citizeness Zielkova."
People in the orchestra began to stir and rise from their seats. And finally, a man whose name was, in fact, Parchevsky, and who had turned red with astonishment, retrieved the deck of cards from his wallet and, not knowing what else to do with it, began poking it in the air.
"Keep it as a souvenir," yelled Fagot. "You weren't kidding yesterday when you said at supper that if it weren't for poker, your life in Moscow would be totally unbearable."
"That's an old trick," shouted someone from the balcony. "The guy in the orchestra is part of the act."
"You think so?"
bellowed Fagot, narrowing his eyes at the balcony.
"In that case, you're part of the act, too, because now the deck is in your pocket."
There was a stir in the balcony, and a joyous voice rang out,
"It's true! He does have it! Here, here! But wait! They're 10-ruble notes!"
The spectators in the orchestra turned their heads. In the balcony, a perplexed citizen had found a packet of bills in his pocket, wrapped the way they are at the bank, with the words, 1,000 rubles, written on top. His neighbors descended upon him, while he, flabbergasted, picked at the wrapper with his nail, trying to ascertain whether the notes were real or make-believe.
"By God, they're real! 10-ruble notes!
Came joyous shouts from the balcony.
"Play me a game with a pack like that,"
said a fat man merrily, who was seated in the center of the orchestra.
"Avec plaisir," replied Fagot. "But why just you? Everyone will take part."
And he gave a command.
"Everybody, look up, please! 1!
A pistol appeared in his hand.
2!
He shouted. The pistol jerked upwards.
3!
He shouted. There was a flash, a bang, and suddenly, white pieces of paper began to rain down onto the hall, falling from the dome ceiling and diving in between the trapezes. They whirled all around, scattered off to the sides, pelted the balcony, piled into the orchestra pit and onto the stage. Within seconds, growing thicker as it fell, the rain of bills had reached the seats, and the audience began catching them. Hundreds of hands went up. People held the bills up to the light from the stage and found watermarks that were perfectly genuine and authentic. The smell of the bills also left no room for doubt. It was the incomparably delectable smell of newly minted money. First merriment and then astonishment swept the theater. It was all abuzz with the words, 10 ruble notes, 10 ruble notes. And happy laughter was heard, and shouts of, ah, ah. Some people were already crawling in the aisles, looking under the seats, and many were standing on top of their seats, trying to catch the capriciously twirling bills. The faces of the policemen began to look more and more bewildered, and performers piled out from backstage. In the dress circle, a voice was heard saying, "What's that you're grabbing? That's mine. It was coming toward me." Another voice yelled, "Don't push me or I'll push you back." And suddenly a slap was heard, whereupon a policeman's helmet appeared in the dress circle and someone was taken away. The general excitement grew in intensity, and no one knows how it all would have ended if Fagot had not put a stop to the shower of rubles by suddenly blowing into the air. Two young men exchanged a happy and meaningful glance, got up from their seats, and headed straight for the buffet. The theater was abuzz, and all eyes gleamed with excitement. Yes, yes, who knows how it all would have ended if Bengalski had not summoned up the strength to do something. Making an effort to regain his composure, he rubbed his hands together in his customary way, and his voice resonated loudly. "Citizens, we have just witnessed an example of so-called mass hypnosis, a purely scientific experiment designed to prove beyond a doubt that there are no miracles and that magic does not exist. Let's ask Maestro Voland to show us how the experiment was done. Now, citizens, you shall see how these paper bills that seem to be money will disappear as suddenly as they appeared." Here he began to clap, but no one joined in. As he clapped, a confident smile played on his face, but that same confidence was not reflected in his eyes. They, on the contrary, were full of entreaty. The audience did not like Bengalski's speech. A total silence ensued, which was then broken by the checked Fagot.
"Yet another example of what we call balderdash," he announced in a loud, braying tenor. "The paper bills, citizens, are real money."
"Bravo!" a bass bellowed out from somewhere on high.
"And by the way," said Fagot, pointing at Bengalski, "this fellow is getting to be a bore. He keeps butting in when nobody asks him to and spoiling the performance with his bogus comments. What should we do with him?"
"Tear off his head," came a stern voice from the balcony.
"What did you say? What was that?"
said Fagot, responding to the ugly suggestion.
"Tear off his head? Now, that's an idea! Behemoth!" he screamed to the cat. "Do it! Eins, zwei, drei!"
Then an incredible thing happened. The cat's black fur stood on end, and he let out a spine-tingling meow. Then he shrunk into a ball and, like a panther, lunged straight at Bengalski's chest and from there leaped onto his head. With a low growl, the cat stuck his chubby paws into the MC's greasy hair and, with a savage howl, tore the head off its thick neck in two twists. The 2,500 people in the theater screamed in unison. Fountains of blood spurted from the severed arteries in the neck and poured down the MC's shirt front and tailcoat. The headless body's legs buckled absurdly, and it plopped onto the floor. The hysterical screams of women were heard. The cat handed the head to Fagot, who lifted it up by the hair and showed it to the audience. And the head cried out desperately to the whole theater,
"Get a doctor!" "Are you going to keep on talking rubbish?"
Fagot inquired of the weeping head in threatening tones.
"I won't any more," rasped the head.
"Stop torturing him, for God's sake!"
shouted a woman in the loge. The magician turned in her direction.
"So, ladies and gentlemen, should we forgive him?"
asked Fagot, addressing the audience.
"Yes, forget him! Forget him!" shouted individual and, for the most part, female voices, which then joined with male voices to form a single chorus.
"What is your command, monsieur?"
asked Fagot of the man in the mask. "Well," the latter replied pensively, "they are like people anywhere. They love money, but that has always been true. People love money, no matter what it is made of, leather, paper, bronze, or gold. And they are thoughtless. But then again, sometimes mercy enters their hearts. They are ordinary people. On the whole, they remind me of their predecessors. Only the housing shortage has had a bad effect on them." And in a loud voice he commanded, "Put his head back on." Taking care to make sure it was on right, the cat plopped the head back in place, and it sat on the neck as if it had never left. And most important, not even a scar was left on the neck. The cat swept his paws over Biangalski's shirt front and tailcoat, and the bloodstains vanished. Fagot lifted the seated Biangalski to his feet, stuck a packet of 10-ruble bills into his coat pocket, and directed him off stage with the words, "Get lost. It's more fun without you." Swaying and looking around in a daze, the MC made it only as far as the fire extinguisher, and there he got sick. He cried in woe, "My head! My head!" Rimsky was among those who rushed over to him. The MC cried, grabbed at the air with his hands, and mumbled, "Give me back my head! Give me back my head! Take my apartment! Take my pictures! Only give me back my head!" A messenger ran for a doctor. People urged Biangalski to lie down on a couch in the dressing room, but he fought them off and got rowdy. An ambulance had to be called. When the unfortunate MC had been carted off, Rimsky ran back to the stage, only to find new miracles in progress. And by the way, it was either then or a short time before that the magician and his faded armchair disappeared from the stage, something which the audience failed to notice, totally absorbed, as it was, in the extraordinary things Fagot was doing on stage. After dispatching the ailing MC, Fagot made the following announcement.
"Now that we've gotten rid of that bore, let's open a store for the ladies."
Suddenly, the stage floor was covered with Persian rugs. Huge mirrors appeared, illuminated along the sides by elongated green bulbs, and between the mirrors were glass display cases, where the audience, in a state of happy bedazzlement, beheld Parisian frocks in various colors and styles. These were in some of the cases, and in others were hundreds of hats, with feathers and without, and hundreds of shoes, with buckles and without, black, white, yellow, leather, satin, suede, shoes with straps and shoes with gems. Containers of perfume appeared among the shoes, as well as mountains of chamois, satin and silk handbags with piles of elongated, embossed gold lipstick cases scattered in between them. The devil only knows where the red-haired girl in the black evening dress came from, who was standing by the display cases with a proprietary smile, her beauty marred only by a strange scar on her neck. With a saccharine smile, Fagot announced to the women in the audience that the store would exchange their old clothes and shoes for Parisian styles and Parisian shoes. He added that the same sort of exchange would apply to handbags and the like. The cat scraped his hind paw and simultaneously gestured with his front paw the way doormen do upon opening the door. Sweetly, albeit with a touch of throatiness, the redhead began to recite words which were baffling but seductive, judging by the women's faces in the orchestra. Guerlain, Chanel No. 5, Mitsuko, Narcisse Noir, evening gowns, cocktail dresses. Fagot twisted and squirmed, the cat bowed, and the girl opened the glass cases.
"Be our guests," bellowed Fagot. "No need to be shy or stand on ceremony."
The audience was excited, but no one as yet made any move to go up on stage. Finally, a brunette stepped out of the 10th row of the orchestra and, smiling as if to say she had nothing better to do, came down the aisle and walked up the side stairs to the stage.
"'Bravo!' cried Fagot. "'Greetings to our first customer. "'Behemoth, bring the lady a chair. "'Shall we begin with shoes, madame?'
The brunette sat down in the chair, whereupon Fagot laid out a whole pile of shoes on the carpet in front of her. She took off her right shoe, tried on a lilac one, tapped her foot on the carpet, and examined the heel.
"'Won't they pinch?' she asked thoughtfully. "'Madame! Madame!' exclaimed Fagot in offended tones, and the cat gave an insulted meow.
"'I'll take this pair, monsieur,' said the brunette with dignity as she put on the other shoe. The brunette's old shoes were thrown behind the curtain, and she herself headed in that direction, accompanied by the redhead and Fagot, who was carrying hangers draped with an assortment of dresses in different styles. The cat fussed about, offered assistance, and hung a tape measure around his neck in order to look more important. A minute later, the brunette came out from behind the curtain, wearing a dress that made the entire orchestra section gasp. The brave woman, whose appearance had improved amazingly, stopped in front of the mirror, straightened her bare shoulders, touched the hair at the back of her neck, and twisted around, trying to get a look at herself from the rear.
"'The firm asks you to accept this as a memento,' said Fagot, handing her an open box with a bottle of perfume inside. "'Merci,'
the brunette answered haughtily, and she went back down to her seat. As she walked up the aisle, people jumped up trying to touch the box. And at this point, all hell broke loose. Women came onto the stage from all directions. Above the general din of excited chatter, laughter, and sighs, a man's voice was heard saying, "'I won't let you!' and a woman's voice riposting,
"'Tyrant! Philistine! Don't break my arm!'
Women disappeared behind the curtain, left their dresses there, and came out wearing new ones. An entire row of ladies sat on gilt-legged stools, energetically tapping the carpet with their newly shod feet. Fagot was down on his knees, assisting with a metal shoehorn. The cat was wearing himself out, trudging back and forth between the display cases and the stools, weighted down with piles of handbags and shoes. The redhead with the disfigured neck would appear and disappear, and it got to the point where she was chattering away exclusively in French. And amazingly, the women understood everything she said, even those who did not know a word of French. There was general astonishment when a man made his way onto the stage and announced that his wife had influenza and that he was there to ask for something on her behalf. To prove that he was married, the man was ready to show his passport. The declaration of the concerned husband provoked laughter. Fagot yelled that he believed him completely even without a passport and handed him two pairs of silk stockings. The cat, for his part, threw in a lipstick case. The women who were latecomers rushed onto the stage, while the lucky ones poured off it, dressed in ball gowns, lounging pajamas with dragons, severely cut suits, and hats tilted over the eyebrow. Then Fagot announced that due to the late hour, in exactly 1 minute, the store would be closing until tomorrow evening. There was an incredible uproar on stage. Women snatched up shoes in haste without even trying them on. One woman swept behind the curtain like a tempest, tore off her clothes, and grabbed the first thing in sight, a silk robe with a huge floral design, and for good measure, she grabbed two bottles of perfume, too. Exactly a minute later, a shot rang out. The mirrors disappeared, the display cases and stools vanished, and the carpet melted into thin air along with the curtain. The last thing to disappear was the mountain of old dresses and shoes, and the stage again became stark, empty, and bare. And then a new character got involved in the act. A pleasant, resonant, and very persistent baritone was heard coming from box number two.
"'Just the same, citizen artiste. It would be much appreciated if you would reveal to the audience the techniques you use in your magic, especially the trick with the paper bills. The return of the MC to the stage would also be appreciated. The audience is worried about his fate.'
The baritone belonged to none other than Arkady Apollonovich Sempliyarov, a guest of honor at that evening's performance, and the chairman of the Acoustics Commission for Moscow Theaters. Arkady Apollonovich was seated in a box with two ladies, one older, expensively and stylishly dressed, and the other young, pretty, and dressed more simply. The former was Arkady Apollonovich's wife, as the official report of the proceedings would later reveal, and the latter was a distant relative of his, an aspiring young actress, who had arrived from Saratov and was staying with Arkady Apollonovich and his wife in their apartment.
"Pardon," retorted Fagot. "I beg your pardon, but there is nothing to reveal here. Everything is clear."
"No, I'm sorry. An exposé is absolutely imperative. Otherwise, your brilliant act will leave a painful impression. The audience demands an explanation."
"The audience," said the impudent buffoon, interrupting Siemplyarov, "seems to have said nothing, right? But in deference to your wishes, I shall begin the exposé in a moment. However, for that purpose, will you allow me to present one final little number?"
"Why not?" replied Arkady Apollonovich in a condescending tone, "but make sure it comes with an exposé."
"Of course, of course. Well then, Arkady Apollonovich, may I ask you where you were yesterday evening?"
Upon hearing this inappropriate and possibly even rude question, Arkady Apollonovich's face changed dramatically.
"Yesterday evening, Arkady Apollonovich was at a meeting of the Acoustics Commission," declared Arkady Apollonovich's wife very haughtily. "But I don't understand what this has to do with magic."
"Oui, madame," confirmed Fagot.
"Naturally you don't. As for the meeting, you're completely mistaken. Arkady Apollonovich left for the alleged meeting, which, to set the record straight, was not scheduled for yesterday. And then, when he got to Chistye Prudy, where the Acoustics Commission meets, he let his driver go."
The whole audience grew hushed.
"And went by bus to Yelachovsky Street to pay a visit to Militsa Andreevna Pokobatko, an actress in a touring regional company, and he stayed there for about 4 hours.
"Oh," came an anguished cry in the hushed silence. Arkady Apollonovich's young relative suddenly let out a low-pitched, terrifying laugh.
"That explains everything," she exclaimed. "And I've had my suspicions for a long time. Now I know why that third-rater got the part of Louisa."
And then she suddenly waved her short, stubby, lilac umbrella and hit Arkady Apollonovich over the head. The vile Fagot, alias Korovyov, cried out,
"Here you have, respected citizens, the kind of exposé which Arkady Apollonovich so persistently asked for. You wretched woman, how dare you lay a hand on Arkady Apollonovich?" threatened his spouse, rising up to her full height in the box.
The young relative was seized with another fit of satanic laughter.
"If anyone can lay a hand on him, I certainly can," she answered through her laughter, and again her umbrella was heard, cracking Arkady Apollonovich over the head. "Police, arrest her!" shrieked Madame Siemplyarov in such a terrifying voice that it made many people's blood run cold. And at this point, the cat leaped up to the footlights and roared out to the theater in a human voice, "The show is over! Maestro, hack out a march!" The half-crazed conductor, only dimly aware of what he was doing, waved his baton, and the orchestra did not so much start to play, burst out in, or even strike up, but rather, to use the cat's repulsive expression, it hacked out an improbable march, so sloppily played that it did not resemble a march at all. For a moment, it seemed as if the half-clear, semi-distinct, yet provocative words of the march had been heard once upon a time in a café chantant somewhere under southern skies. His Excellency had a taste for domestic fowl and was always on the prowl for good-looking chicks. Or maybe those were not the words. And there were other ones to the same music, which were also highly indecent. That's not important. What is important is that after this, something like the fall of the Tower of Babel broke out in the Variety Theater. The police rushed to the Semplyarov's box, curiosity seekers climbed onto the railing, hellish bursts of laughter and mad shrieks were heard, which were drowned out by the golden crash of cymbals coming from the orchestra pit. And the stage was suddenly empty. And both the trickster Fagot and the huge, brazen cat behemoth had melted into thin air and vanished, just as the magician and his faded armchair had vanished before them.
Chapter 13. Enter the Hero. And so the stranger pressed a warning finger to his lips and whispered, "Shh," to Ivan. Ivan lowered his feet over the side of the bed and stared. Peering cautiously into the room from the balcony was a clean-shaven, dark-haired man of about 38. He had anxious eyes, a sharp nose, and a shock of hair hanging over his forehead. After making certain that Ivan was alone, the mysterious visitor listened intently, then mustered his courage and entered the room. Ivan noticed that he was wearing hospital clothes, underwear, slippers on bare feet, and a dark brown robe thrown over his shoulders. The newcomer winked at Ivan, stuck a bunch of keys in his pocket, and asked in a whisper, "May I sit down?" When he received a nod of assent, he settled into the armchair.
"How did you get in here?"
said Ivan in a whisper, obeying his guest's warning gesture.
"Aren't the window grills locked?"
"They are locked," confirmed the guest. "But Praskovya Fyodorovna is an extremely nice, if, alas, absent-minded person. I pinched her keys a month ago, which allows me to go out onto the balcony that encircles the entire floor and thus visit a neighbor on occasion."
"But if you can go out onto the balcony, you can get out of here.
Or is it too high up?" queried Ivan. "No," was the guest's firm reply. "It's not because it's too high that I can't get out, but because there's nowhere for me to get out to." After a pause, he added, "So, we're stuck sitting here?"
"Yes, stuck," replied Ivan, gazing into the newcomer's anxious-looking brown eyes.
"Yes." Here the guest suddenly became agitated. "I hope you're not violent, are you? Because, you see, I can't tolerate noise, rows, violence, or anything of that sort. And I especially can't stand people screaming, whether in suffering, rage, or for any other reason. Reassure me. Tell me, you're not violent, are you?"
"Yesterday in a restaurant I smashed some guy in the puss," confessed the transformed poet manfully.
"The reason?" the guest asked sternly.
"None, really, I admit," answered Ivan, becoming embarrassed.
"Disgraceful," the guest scolded, and added, "and besides, why do you say things like smash some guy in the puss? After all, nobody knows exactly what it is that a man has, a face or a puss. Most likely it's still a face, so when it comes to fists, no, you should stop doing that sort of thing once and for all."
After giving Ivan this lecture, the guest inquired, "Your profession?"
"Poet," Ivan acknowledged, somewhat unwillingly.
The newcomer became distressed.
"Oh, how unlucky I am," he exclaimed, but then caught himself, apologized, and asked, "And what is your name?"
"Bezdomny."
"Uh-oh," said the guest with a frown.
"What's the matter? Don't you like my poetry?" asked Ivan with curiosity.
"Emphatically not."
"And what have you read?"
"I haven't read any of your poetry,"
retorted the visitor irritably.
"Then how can you tell?" "Well," replied the guest, "it's not as if I haven't read other things like it, now is it? But maybe, by some miracle, yours is different? All right, I'm ready to take it on faith. Tell me yourself, are your poems any good?"
"Horrible," Ivan blurted out boldly and frankly.
"Don't write any more," the newcomer implored. "I promise you, I swear I won't," was Ivan's solemn reply.
They sealed the vow with a handshake, and then the sounds of soft footsteps and voices were heard from the corridor.
"Shh,"
whispered the guest, jumping out onto the balcony and closing the grill behind him. Praskovya Fyodorovna looked in and asked how Ivan was feeling and whether he wanted to sleep in the dark or with a light. Ivan asked her to leave the light on, and Praskovya Fyodorovna exited after wishing the patient good night. And, when everything had quieted down, the guest came back again. He told Ivan in a whisper that a new patient had just been brought into room 119, a fat fellow with a purple face who kept muttering something about foreign currency in the ventilator shaft and who swore that evil powers had settled into his building on Sadovaya Street.
He's cursing out Pushkin for all he's worth and shouting, "Kuroliesov, encore, encore," said the guest, twitching anxiously. When he calmed down, he took a seat and said, "But never mind about him," and continued his conversation with Ivan. "So how did you end up here?"
"Because of Pontius Pilate," Ivan replied, looking sullenly down at the floor.
"What?"
shouted the guest, abandoning caution and then clamping his hand over his mouth.
"A striking coincidence. I beg you, tell me all about it."
Feeling for some reason that he could trust the stranger, Ivan began telling him about yesterday's happenings at Patriarch's Ponds, starting out haltingly and timidly, but then growing bolder as he went along. And indeed Ivan Nikolaevich found a sympathetic listener in this mysterious key thief. The guest did not treat Ivan as if he were a madman, showed the greatest interest in what he was saying, and became ecstatic as the story progressed. He kept interrupting Ivan with exclamations.
"Well, well, go on, I beg you. Only in the name of all that's holy, don't leave anything out."
Ivan left nothing out, for he himself found it easier to tell the story that way, and gradually he got to the point where Pontius Pilate came out on the balcony in his white cloak with the blood-red lining. The guest then folded his hands as if in prayer and whispered,
"Oh, I guessed right. I guessed everything right."
Following the description of Berlioz's horrible death, the listener made a puzzling remark and his eyes flashed with hatred.
"I'm just sorry that it wasn't Latunsky, the critic, or that hack Mstislav Lavrovich instead of Berlioz."
And in a frenzy, but noiselessly, he exclaimed,
"Go on!"
The cat who paid his fare was a big hit with the guest, and he choked with silent laughter as he watched Ivan, excited by the success of his storytelling, jump down on his haunches and pantomime the cat holding a coin up to his whiskers. "And so," Ivan concluded, after telling about the events at Griboyedov and again becoming gloomy and sad, "that's how I wound up here." The guest laid a sympathetic hand on the poor poet's shoulder and said,
"Unhappy poet. But you, dear fellow, brought it all on yourself. You shouldn't have acted so carelessly, even rudely, with him. Now you're paying the price. Why, you should be grateful you got off relatively cheaply." "But who was he, anyway?" asked Ivan, shaking his fists in agitation.
The guest stared at Ivan and answered with a question.
"You're not going to get all upset now, are you? All of us here are unstable. There won't be any calls for the doctor or injections or other stuff like that, will there?"
"No, no,"
exclaimed Ivan. "Just tell me who he is."
"All right, then," replied the guest, weighing his words and speaking distinctly. "Yesterday, at Patriarch's Ponds, you had a meeting with Satan." As he had promised, Ivan did not go berserk, but he was, nevertheless, totally flabbergasted.
"That can't be. He doesn't exist. I beg your pardon. You're the last person in the world who should say such a thing. You were obviously one of the first ones to suffer at his hands, and here you are, as you very well know, in a mental hospital, and yet you still claim that he doesn't exist. I find that really rather strange."
Completely befuddled, Ivan fell silent.
"As soon as you began describing him," the guest continued, "I guessed who it was you had the pleasure of conversing with yesterday. And I'm really surprised at Berlioz. You, of course, are still an innocent." Here the guest again apologized. "But he, at least, from what I've heard, had read a thing or two. The very first words the professor spoke confirmed all my suspicions. It's impossible not to recognize him, my friend, and besides, you're, forgive me for saying so, you're, if I'm not mistaken, an ignorant man, are you not?"
"Absolutely," agreed the now unrecognizable Ivan.
"So there you see. Why, even the face you described, the dissimilar eyes, the eyebrows. By the way, forgive me, but you probably haven't even heard the opera Faust, have you?"
Ivan became terribly, strangely embarrassed for some reason, and with a flushed face started mumbling something about a trip to a sanitarium in Yalta.
"There you are, there you are. It's not surprising. But Berlioz, I repeat, amazes me. He's not only very well read, he's also very shrewd.
although I must say in his defense that Voland could certainly pull the wool over the eyes of someone far shrewder than he.
What? Ivan shouted out in return. Quiet!
Ivan slapped himself on the forehead and said in a croak, Now I understand. Now I understand he had the letter W on his visiting card. Well, I'll be. So that's how it is. He fell into a state of befuddled silence for a while, gazing out at the moon floating beyond the window grill, and then he said, So that means he really could have been with Pontius Pilate, doesn't it? Since he was already born then, right? And they call me a madman, Ivan added, pointing in outrage at the door. A bitter grimace distorted the guest's mouth.
Let's look truth straight in the eye, said the guest, turning his face toward the nocturnal orb passing through the clouds beyond the window grill. You and I are both mad. There's no denying it. You see, he shook you up, and you lost your mind because you obviously had tendencies in that direction to begin with. But there's no doubt at all that what you told me really did happen. But it's so bizarre that even a psychiatrist of genius like Stravinsky naturally didn't believe you. Was he the one who examined you?
Ivan nodded.
The man you conversed with was at Pilate's, and he was also at Kant's for breakfast. And now he's paying a visit to Moscow.
Yes, and the devil only knows what mischief he'll do here. Shouldn't we try and catch him? Said the not entirely suppressed old Ivan, rearing his head from inside the new one, although without much confidence.
You already tried, and look where it got you, was the guest's ironic response. I wouldn't advise others to try it either, but rest assured that he'll cause more trouble. Oh, how annoying it is that you are the one to meet him, and not I. Even though I'm all burnt out, and the coals have turned to ash, I swear I would have given up Praskovya Fyodorovna's keys for a meeting like that, and they're all I have to give up. I'm a poor man.
But what do you need him for?
The guest was sad for a long time, and his face twitched, but finally he said, You see, strangely enough, I'm in here for the same reason you are, namely because of Pontius Pilate. Here the guest looked around anxiously and said, The fact is that a year ago I wrote a novel about Pilate.
You're a writer? Asked the poet with interest.
The guest's face darkened, and he shook his fist at Ivan and then said, I am the master. He became stern, reached into the pocket of his robe and took out a grimy black cap that had the letter M embroidered on it in yellow silk. He put the cap on and modeled it for Ivan in profile and full face, in order to prove that he was the master.
She sewed this for me with her own hands, he added mysteriously.
What's your name?
I no longer have a name,
the strange guest replied with gloomy disdain. I gave it up, just as I've given up everything else in life. Let's drop the subject.
Well, then at least tell me about your novel, requested Ivan tactfully.
By all means. My life has turned out to be anything but ordinary, if I do say so myself, the guest began.
A historian by training, he had worked until 2 years ago at one of the Moscow museums and had also done translations.
From what language? Ivan inquired with interest.
I know 5 languages besides my own, answered the guest. English, French, German, Latin, and Greek. And I also read a little Italian.
Wow, whispered Ivan with envy.
The historian had lived a solitary life. He had no family anywhere and virtually no friends in Moscow. And then, imagine, one day, he won 100,000 rubles.
You can imagine my surprise, whispered the guest in the black cap, when I rummaged around in the dirty laundry basket and found out I had the same number that was printed in the paper. A ticket given me at the museum, he explained.
After winning 100,000, Ivan's mysterious guest did the following. He bought some books, moved out of his room on Yasnitskaya Street.
Ugh, what a damn hole that was, snarled the guest.
He rented two rooms from a private home builder in the basement of a small house in a garden on a small street near the Arbat. He quit his job at the museum and began to write a novel about Pontius Pilate.
Ah, that was a golden age, the narrator whispered, his eyes shining. It was a completely private apartment, with its own entrance and a sink with running water, he emphasized with particular pride for some reason, and small windows looking out over the path leading to the gate. Just opposite in front of the fence, not more than four steps away, there were lilac bushes, a linden tree, and a maple. Once in a while in winter, I'd see someone's black feet through the window, and I'd hear the snow crunching as they walked by. And there was always a fire burning in my stove. But then spring came suddenly, and through the dim glass I saw the lilac branches, which had first been bare, now dressed in green. And then last spring something happened that was far more entrancing than winning 100,000 rubles. And that, you will agree, is a huge sum of money.
Yes, it is, agreed Ivan, who was listening attentively. I had opened the window and was sitting in the second and tinier of the two rooms. The guest used his hands to illustrate. A couch, and across from it another couch, and between them a small table with a beautiful night lamp on it, and closer to the window, books. Here a small desk, and in the first room, an enormous room, 14 square meters, books, more books, and a stove. Ah, what a great place I had! The smell of the lilacs was extraordinary. And I was becoming light-headed from exhaustion, and Pilate was flying to an end. White cloak, blood-red lining, I understand, exclaimed Ivan. Exactly! Pilate was flying to an end, and I already knew that the last words of the novel would be, the fifth procurator of Judea, the knight Pontius Pilate. Well, naturally, I'd go for walks. 100,000 is a huge sum. And I had a handsome suit. Or I'd dine at some inexpensive restaurant. There was a marvelous restaurant on the Arbat. I don't know if it's still there. Here the guest's eyes opened wide, and he continued whispering as he gazed at the moon. She was carrying some hideous, disturbing yellow flowers. The devil only knows what they're called, but for some reason they're the first ones to bloom in Moscow. And those flowers stood out very distinctly against her black spring coat. She was carrying yellow flowers, a bad color. She turned off Tverskaya into a side street and then looked back. Do you know Tverskaya? Thousands of people were walking along Tverskaya, but I assure you, she saw only me, and she gave me a look that was not merely anxious, but even pained. And I was struck not so much by her beauty, as by the extraordinary, incomparable loneliness in her eyes. Obeying that yellow sign, I too turned into the side street and followed her. We walked silently along the dull, winding lane, I on one side and she on the other. And imagine, there wasn't a soul in the street. I was in torment, because I felt that I had to talk to her, and I was afraid I wouldn't be able to utter a word. And she would go away, and I would never see her again. And then, imagine, she said unexpectedly, "Do you like my flowers?" I distinctly remember the sound of her voice, rather low but halting. And however silly this may seem, I felt that an echo sounded in the lane and reverberated off the dirty yellow wall. I quickly crossed over to her side of the street and, walking up to her, replied, "No." She looked at me with surprise, and I suddenly and completely unexpectedly realized that this was the woman I had loved my whole life. Amazing, isn't it? Naturally, you'll say, I'm a madman, right? I'm not saying anything, Ivan exclaimed, adding, please go on. And the guest continued, yes, she gave me a look of surprise. And then she asked, is it that you just don't like flowers? I thought I detected hostility in her voice. I walked alongside her, trying to keep in step with her, and to my surprise, I felt no constraint whatsoever. No, I like flowers, but not those, I said.
What kind do you like?
I like roses. Then I regretted having said that because she smiled guiltily and threw her flowers into the gutter. A bit flustered, I retrieved them nonetheless and handed them back to her, but she pushed them away with a smile and I ended up carrying them. Thus we walked in silence for a while until she took the flowers out of my hand and threw them on the pavement. Then she put her hand in a flared black glove through my arm, and we walked off together.
"Go on," said Ivan, "and please don't leave anything out."
"Go on," the guest echoed. "Well, you yourself can guess what happened next."
Suddenly he wiped away an unexpected tear with his right sleeve and continued. "Just like a murderer jumps out of nowhere in an alley, love jumped out in front of us and struck us both at once, the way lightning strikes or a Finnish knife. She, by the way, would later say that it wasn't like that, that we had, of course, loved each other for a very long time without knowing or ever having seen each other, and that she was living with another man. And I was then with that... what's her name?"
"With whom?" asked Bezdomny.
"With that... well, with that... well..." the guest answered, snapping his fingers.
"You were married?"
"Well, yes. That's why I'm snapping my fingers. To that Varyanka."
"Manechka.
No, Varyanka. With the striped dress at the museum. But I can't remember. And so she used to say that she had gone out that day carrying the yellow flowers so that I would at last find her. And that if it hadn't happened, she would have poisoned herself because her life was empty. Yes, love struck us instantly. I knew it that very day, an hour later, when we lost track of where we were and found ourselves on the embankment by the Kremlin Wall. We talked as if we had parted only the day before, as if we had known each other for many years. We agreed to meet the next day on the same spot by the Moscow River, and we did. The May sun was shining for us, and very, very soon afterwards, that woman became my secret wife. She would come to me every day, and from morning on I'd start waiting for her. My impatience expressed itself in the way I endlessly rearranged the things on my table. 10 minutes before she arrived, I would sit by the window and start listening for the creaking sound of the decrepit gate. And oddly, before I met her, hardly anyone, in fact no one, ever visited our little yard. But now it seemed that the whole city was beating a path to our door. The gate would creak, my heart would jump, and imagine I'd look through the window, and there, level with my head, I'd see a pair of dirty boots, a knife grinder. Who in my house would need a knife grinder? What was there to sharpen? What sort of knives? She would come through the gate only once, but until that happened, my heart would suffer at least 10 palpitations. I'm not lying. And then, when it was time for her arrival and the hands were pointing to noon, my heart wouldn't stop pounding until her shoes noiselessly, without tapping, with their black suede bows and steel buckles, drew level with the window. Sometimes she'd play games and stop at the second window and tap her toe against the glass. I'd be at the window in a second, only to find that the shoes had disappeared along with the black silk dress that blocked the sun, and I'd go and let her in. Nobody knew about our affair. I can swear to that, although that rarely happens. Her husband didn't know, and neither did her friends. Of course, the people in the old house where my basement apartment was knew. They could see a woman was coming to visit me. But they did not know her name.
"And what was her name?"
asked Ivan, who was totally mesmerized by the love story. The guest made a gesture indicating that he would never tell anyone her name, and went on with his story.
This ends Disc 5.